Welcome to the Playing With Words podcast. I'm Adrian Harris, and I'm an actor, writer, director, and what some of you may not know, I'm also a sound designer, having created sound for most of the productions at Brasswicks Theatre. This series of podcasts follows me through my journey to write a new play, as I was fortunate enough to receive a creative freelancer grant from the West of England Combined Authority. Now for this project, I'm trying a different approach to creating new work. It's going to be a play, I'm familiar with those, having written quite a few, but with all the changes and demands now placed on theatre due to the pandemic, I'm working with a small cast, but hoping to deliver some big ideas. And one of the ways I hope to do this is by exploring how to create offstage characters and a whole emotional landscape using sound during the writing process. So before I begin to even put pen to paper or finger to keyboard, let alone pick up my field recorder, I thought it best to speak to a friend and fellow writer, composer and sound designer, Tim X. Atack, about what he does and how he found his way into the industry and an insight into his creative process. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Firstly, would you like to tell us what you do by way of summing up your vast and successful career so far?
Vast and successful. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, you can be the judge of that. I'm a writer and composer, I guess. It kind of boils down to those two elements mostly, but it also involves bits and pieces of like filmmaking, a bit of performing, and I play in bands and I make records and stuff like that. And when I was growing up, I wanted to write music for film and TV. Specifically, I kind of like had my heart set on a job at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And when I was at school, I got into synthesizers and music tech and that kind of thing. But I couldn't read music, so I had this plan that involved studying film and theatre at university, but being the guy who made soundtracks for everyone. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. My plan worked. And that not only led to working immediately after graduation with people like Matt Lucas and David Walliams and Edgar Wright, I'd also formed a band called Angel Tech. And we landed ourselves a record deal. But crucially, this deal also involved making films for all the songs on our debut album. And I discovered that I really like the rigor of script writing these things. And I like that rigor and working to other people's ideas and sort of prompts in a way that in script writing, I liked it in a way that had never really been a strong point for me when making music. I'd always been a much more awkward customer when making music. So I gradually shifted into script writing over the course of probably about 20 years or so, bit by bit, on top of a bunch of part-time jobs that allowed me to keep creative. And I was working out during that time what kind of writer I wanted to be, I suppose. So I started writing for radio in about 2012 and slowly started to get things optioned for screen and stuff like that. And I keep knocking at the theatre door occasionally, and, you know, a bit like the beginning of Return of the Jedi or whatever, a robot eye comes out and asks me some questions and then laughs at me and then darts back into the dark and shuts the door again. But there you go. So it's not been so much a successful career, as it were, as more of a kind of like a slalom in and out of success. That's what it's felt like.
You say you're knocking at the door of theatre, mm-hmm. and you had the great success of winning the Bruntwood Prize in 2017.
Yeah.
How did that change your approach to playwriting?
Well, it's sort of, if anything, it kind of like made me realise what a road I have to travel in terms of communicating the ideas I'd like to see on theatre stages.
Yeah.
I mean, I have my own company called Sleep Dogs that I co-founded with a partner who's also my partner about like sort of a decade ago now. And we sort of like formed that company as a means of kind of creating the sort of theatre that we wanted to see where the dramaturgical ideas weren't really being pushed at the time by many theatres that we knew of, or at least we hadn't encountered the allies to do those things at that stage. So it was kind of like following our curiosity and trying to do some kind of like stuff that we felt was relatively progressive and like sort of exciting to us, and used techniques that came from outside of theatre as well as strictly theatrical techniques. And so as I've been setting myself up as a writer you know, outside of Sleep Dogs in the last decade or so. The way I was doing that was mostly by things like entering competitions. So it's been an interesting journey with the play that won the Brentwood, because it's kind of like it's still trying to find its home. It's still trying to find the people who might believe in it.
Yeah.
And so that's a task for me for coming out of lockdown, really, is finding the kind of like the people who'll want to make this quite, I don't say this very often of my own work, but quite frankly, this astonishing play. And I'd really like to find these people to make it with. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a great point for playwrights to remember. It is a journey you go on, and even winning a major prize, it doesn't mean that it's the end for that piece.
It's not a magic wand. And I think there's also the great risk that, as in any other art form, there's a point at which kind of like you construct these things, and it's not, the script isn't the final result. It never is. It's always kind of like whether you want to look at it as a blueprint or a seed for the production. I think it's always going to be something along those lines rather than a done deal. The interesting thing for me about an awful lot of theatre practice in the UK at the moment is the script is very often kind of seen as the done deal. An awful lot of the work is done in the script, and it's expected to be done in the script, and that's not the kind of theatre I make. So it's weird. I have a lot of conversations about scripts as kind of like being the play. Like the text is at the center of everything. And it's not, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a musician, but I just don't see creativity that way. I see it as something that happens when a whole bunch of people get into a room and start work.
Yeah. In fact, one of my favorite jokes is, how many playwrights does it take to change a light bulb? What? I'm not changing anything. Well, as you know, this project I'm working on is creating a new play in a different way than I would normally approach a script.
Yeah.
Not only am I building story and characters, but I'm looking at the world of the play as sound, and possibly some characters that will only exist as some sort of audio. And all this before I start even writing the play.
Mm.
I guess I'm hoping to experiment with sound during the drafting of the work, while developing my creative practice as a sound designer and trying a new approach to writing and seeing what happens. So my question for you is, do you find yourself conscious of the world of sound when you begin writing a new script?
Mm-hmm. Always, pretty much always. I mean, it's part of my brain that I can't switch off. and I guess amongst other things, it's because I'm kind of like an old-fashioned modernist composer in many ways, in that I consider all types of noise to be music. Sound is present for me right from the beginning, and I guess there's an argument that if I can't hear the script as much as read it, then I'm not happy. If I'm writing for these are very, very broad terms, but if I'm writing for theatre, I tend to gravitate towards the idea of writing for an amount of time. That's kind of like the principal condition that I'm thinking about. If I'm writing for cinema or TV, I'm gravitating towards writing for a frame. And then audio drama is a weird one, because if anything, when I'm writing audio drama, I'm using the same part of my brain as I use when I'm composing. So yeah, the sound is very much part of it, and the whole picture of the sound is very much part of it for me too.
Yes, I'm hoping sound will play a big part in shaping my writing throughout the whole process. And I'm going to experiment with what is represented by sound, be that a mix of abstract, naturalistic and music effects, so the audience don't immediately identify any specific sound. Instead, it'll have more of an emotional quality.
Yeah. That's interesting. I think it makes me think of Tanuja did the sound design for a show by Selena Thompson called Salt, which is kind of, it's this astonishing story of a journey of discovery that Selena takes around the transatlantic slave triangle. And there are points where she travels on a cargo ship, as Selena has herself as kind of like a connection to the cello as an instrument. One of the things that Tanuja decided very early on was to pull together pretty much all the sounds in the show, or as many as possible, from samples of a cello being played. And bit by bit would construct like sort of very, very deep motor sounds and the sounds of the depth of the ocean. And all of these came from manipulating cello notes and tones and scrapes to their absolute extreme.
Yeah, and that's so much more interesting than just adding a stock sound effect of an ocean and a boat.
Well, that's it, and that's that's her practice, and my practice as a sound designer as well is for theatre is not to necessarily turn up with a hard drive full of animal noises or whatever, but it's more to like sort of ask, you know, what are the really, really useful rules that we can give ourselves in this process, and what's going to make it interesting and distinctive and immersive.
Okay, right. So music is a great source of inspiration for writing. But what about abstract sounds? To help me take a different view of how sound is used to engage audiences, I spoke with Alison Bowne, another resident at the Pervasive Media Studio in Bristol, who found her career in sound taking a slightly different creative path through film and video games. Hello, Alison.
Hello.
Could you just give us a potted history of how you found yourself immersed in sound design?
Well, I don't rightly know. No, I do. My dad was a musician. He was a music teacher and a professional musician before we came along and ruined his life and made him teach music. So there was always musical instruments around the house, and I was always encouraged to learn music. And like a lot of people in sound design, my background's in music. But I chose not to do a music degree. I did a drama and English degree. And I just got into... So then I became a community musician, and then I took a... getting into studio engineering course at a local studio, educational studio, when I was about 22. And I just sort of clicked with it. And then as part of my job, I started producing young people, teaching them how to use music technology. So I was teaching myself and teaching them. And once I kind of really got into that, I applied to go to film school. And I got onto the sound course, which I thought had looked really interesting because it looked like a really good combination of storytelling and drama, and the fact that I'd got quite into and confident with studio technology. Got trained, basically, because they train you in your craft, in post-production sound and sound recording, and then it was a two-year course, but a year and a bit into it, we visited EA, the games company, and they were looking for sound designers who were from film. I stayed in touch, and I got offered, I went for about 1,000 interviews and I got offered a job. So then I went to EA, became a sound designer. And after that, I went into Soho and worked with Paul Davis, who I'd interviewed for my MA for the NFTS. That's how I got like my early CV, like my credits, my sort of credits that made me a kind of proper person. And then, typical me, I decided to go write a book and do something else for a bit. And then I got back into sound through my PhD, which combined writing and sound design, and kind of reskilled myself up with programming and stuff, and got back into game audio.
You've collaborated with a variety of artists from theatre and filmmakers and game designers. So out of these differing media, which do you find keeps you going and stretches your creative muscles the most?
So I think what I find has kind of like revived and refreshed me, and now I've kind of found the answer to how you keep yourself interested and push yourself and don't get bored of yourself. And ultimately, in my case, don't give up doing it because you're bored and you can see more interesting, challenging things to do, is actually to think about your compositional approach. And I think different types of collaborations or different types of processes are what are the most challenging. And if I was going to go and study something else ever, which I might do, once I've recovered from a PhD in 20 years, maybe if I was going to study something, I would like to study composition. And actually what I got interested in through my PhD was compositional approach. Then I was working with written language and sound design, you know, you're trying to figure out, well, where's the sound going to do the job most immediately and most effectively, and what, you know, where's the kind of effect of reading language going to do it, and kind of getting really into the idea of what is the impact of this going to be cognitively on people, you know, like really understanding the decisions that you're making and why you're making them and what you're trying to achieve. So I worked with a choreographer last summer over the really first lockdown. It was just out of my PhD. And what was interesting about that, again, was the approach was very different from anything I'd ever done. We just started by writing some diaries. You know, I was invited to write a diary broadly on the subject of, you know, it was a theme, and everybody was invited to write on that theme. And we just sort of handed them in. And I was like, well, I don't know, you know, and it was really interesting, you know, and then it was like they were sifted and things, common things came forward. So like that process was really interesting. It's almost like a kind of slightly co-created, but with other professionals rather than with, you know, community or whatever. And that was a really interesting approach because you were kind of given some constraints, but a fairly open process. But, you know, the idea was you sort of slightly responded to each other. So that was like stretching. I mean, ultimately, you know, what I actually designed and stuff technically might not have been stretching, but the way that we had to think about the content and how it might play together and all that, you know.
It's a great way to work that challenges you, I guess, and gets you thinking in a different way.
Yeah, I think, you know, now I'm working on an audiobook. That's not unfamiliar because of kind of what I looked at in my PhD, although with PhD it was reading rather than listening to words, it was reading and listening. But again, you know, you kind of like, okay, how are we going to do this? What's the most effective use of the sound if we're going to, you know, if we're going to do anything like, you know, like new with like binaural or whatever, if we're going to go into those spaces, why would we do it? And what effect is it going to have? And, you know, so I think the actual compositional process and that's what kind of stretches you, is when you're looking at bringing different things together, you know, rather than just sort of responding to, you know, a visual, you get given some rushes or you get given, you know, some silent videos and off you go, you know, your job is to sort of fill it out. So I think for me, you know, working with different combinations and different types of work keep you challenged and keep you moving on and getting better at what you do. So I think the other thing is when you work in games, what really pushes you is the fact that you have to implement the audio and it has to exist inside a piece of software. So you have to conceptualize your sound design being in 1,000 different pieces, you know, in literally 1,000 pieces, and it's all going to get recombined, you know. So I always try to explain to sort of non-game people, like if you think of a game engine as like a projector, it literally runs at 25 frames per second, so it's running on a cycle. You have this sort of cycle and it updates and it triggers events at certain points, you know. So your sounds essentially, you know, you can design it in your kind of digital audio workstation to picture, you know, you might have captured it. But then you have to smash it into pieces and you have to think about, well, people could approach it from the back. In some instances in the 3D, they could approach it from the back, the front, the underneath, you know, like what's the gameplay? What's the effect on the player? So, and then you've kind of got to get it in the game. You kind of push it in through these bits of middleware or actually straight into the code. And you're constantly like, right, what will it sound like when it all comes back together on the other side of that process? You know, it's, so that's a kind of creative technical muscle that you sort of have to develop that work, they work together.
So when you're starting a new project, how do you prepare? Where do you go for inspiration?
Whether I'm going to go out and do some recording, whether I'm going to try and create my own sounds, whether I'm going to try to, you know, I often think about the location of a piece, where it's set, the environment, the atmospheres, the place. That's kind of often where I kind of start. And then I perhaps look at, you know, are there any kind of set pieces, big bits of sound design that need doing? You know, an obvious thing would be, you know, if it's got like a spaceship in it or if it's got like a kind of spells in it or anything like that. In one animation, it was like, you know, you had to kind of create the darkness, you know, you have to, this character, the dark, it was the darkness, the guy, the character in the film is like terrified of the dark. So the start has to have a presence, you know. And then you would start thinking about, well, thematically, what are the themes of this story? Like, how am I going to reflect the themes in the sound? That I'm not just plonking random sounds onto this, you know, narrative. So if you start looking at the world and the vibe and the kind of underlying theme and all that kind of stuff, then, you know, start looking for sounds or go out recording sounds. Or when you're out and about, you know, listening to things that could be interesting to record or have certain textures or whatever. I mean, that's kind of like day-to-day habits. And then I think if I was working on a new sound design project and I had a lot of time and a lot of freedom, I would definitely go on a recording trip, because I do think that's kind of where you can really start thinking about textures and collecting your sound library from scratch, you know, before you start editing and actually putting it to something. So you're thinking in a much more kind of abstract plane before you start gluing things onto the canvas, you know, or actually doing the work of putting it on the timeline or and mixing it and making it sound good, you know. And just listening and, you know, like, oh, that sounds really like, oh, that's a really interesting texture, or that's a really interesting way of mixing. Oh, I could really mix something like that where I really bring it forward. And actually, I might just be listening to some insects. When you actually go, I can't recall these insects, there's a road in the background, it's useless. But when you actually think about the experience and what you're hearing, you know, that's more of a kind of moment of like, yeah, that really was foregrounded in the soundscape. That was a very foregrounded, percussive, light sound. And that's something that I'm, you know, kind of aiming for in my mix or whatever, you know.
Yeah. With my new thing, I'm looking at how to create offstage characters out of abstract sound, you know, before I even start writing. Things that I can create that may convey some form of emotional impact to the audience.
I suppose it depends. I was thinking about this. I was thinking, obviously, that's why I mentioned The Darkness, because that was the most obvious example. There's a sort of school of thought about, you know, what's the sound going to do best and what are other things going to do best? And there's a sort of school of thought in musical grammar that one of the things that music and sound does a lot more effectively than other art forms is capture dynamic forces and movement. So if you're talking about characters that are sort of slightly abstract dynamic forces, like darkness or fear or, you know, the environment or the wind or, you know, the kind of climate change or, you know, the depth of the sea or anything like that, then I think then sound definitely can play a character, because you're essentially trying to represent a sort of almost, it's almost like a myth, isn't it? This character is actually a dynamic force. They represent jealousy, or they represent the dark side of someone's personality or whatever, you know, or the light side, conversely. Whereas if you're talking about they're an actual character, I haven't done that. I think you are getting into sort of musical motif-y land there, like, you know, things like Dance of the Bumblebee and stuff like that, where the music or where music tries to emulate certain temperaments or whatever. I think you're getting more into a musical representation of a character trait, say, or a movement or a gesture. But I do think they can represent unseen forces or be a great representation of what a character represents.
Mm-hmm. When we spoke before, you mentioned how important the environment can be in storytelling, using the examples of the video game Dear Esther or of Wuthering Heights and that particular setting in the novel.
Yeah, environmental storytelling. So if you've got something like Dear Esther or whatever, then the landscape is a big part of that, you know, and the sea and everything. And rather than just plonking a sea sound, in that instance, you would really think about, well, what's happening at this point and what's happening at that point. And yeah, it definitely, I guess, I think I said earlier, one of the first places I would go for inspiration is what the setting is, what the environment is. And I've always really enjoyed kind of building environments and working with sounds of weather and, you know, like the impact of the wind and you know, if that's appropriate for that story. And equally, if you've got kind of like a very artificial environment or a very technical environment, I would be more looking to create the experience of being in a cold technical environment rather than lots of bleepy sounds or whatever. I would probably just do something quite plain and stark and bright and percussive. So I think that's where sound does come into its own, because you can create an experience. You can get the audience to actually experience what it's like to be there.
So, I'm going to make a playlist of some songs that will hopefully evoke the period of the piece. which will be a challenge as I'm thinking of sliding between two different timelines throughout the play. And then I'm off outside, field recorder and shotgun mic in hand to gather some environmental sounds to inspire the setting. Next time, I'll be delving into how I'm going to develop my characters, so I hope you'll join me for that. You've been listening to the Playing With Words podcast with me, Adrian Harris, and guests Tim X. Atak and Alison Baum, produced in association with Brasswork Theatre.